This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Thank you, Shannon. Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Dr. Jeff Covan, who leads the newly formed MSU Sports Medicine and Performance.
We're very pleased to have Dr. Jeff Covan join us, who is in a long line of great physicians that the athletic department has had the opportunity to be associated with, but more importantly, an outstanding individual in our community and across our state, a great leader in our industry. And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
I think as we as we jump into some things, there's such a diverse area that you work with in your practice as well as with athletics specifically. But let's start in the athletic realm. The world is changing around us. I think the importance of the health and welfare of student athletes has always been at the forefront of athletic directors, university presidents. But it's an area that we continue to dive deeper and deeper into, and how we can provide the best services, the best advice, the best counsel, and the best care to our student athletes. And perhaps you could go into some of those concepts.
You know, I think from the sports medicine side, it became such a hot topic in probably the 90s and then through the 2000s that all of a sudden physicians who were taking care of athletes were defined as this new sports medicine physician specialty component. In reality, what it was just a number of us that were physicians. Originally, it was all orthopedic surgeons who came in and took care of their athletes, whether it was men or women, whether it was a broken bone or a ligament injury or otherwise. And everything else then got pushed off to family docs out in the community or other places that took care of these kids. What changed back in the early 80s, and actually the people that I trained under here were two gentlemen named Doug McCaig and another gentleman, Dave Howe, who passed away back in 96. They were part of a core group of about five or six physicians in the country who created this concept that sports medicine is a lot more, or taking care of athletes is a lot more than just fixing a broken bone or doing surgery on a shoulder. That an athlete's a much more or larger entity than just that. And sometimes the best way to take care of the athlete is to take care of the whole athlete. And we fix the parts when they're broken, but at the end of the day, it's really the athlete as a whole, personally, spiritually, physically, all the different parts of them that makes them who they are. And they created this with a few other people in the country, and then the network of that exploded through the 90s and 2000s, where early on they were one of five training programs of generally primary care physicians and trained them how to take care of athletes as a whole. And there were five programs in the country. Now there's 150 to 200 programs, and we were one of the first five. And those are the people that I trained under here and followed that belief that our athletes get best served when we take care of the entire athlete. And what you see on the field when an athlete goes down, and whether they've torn a ligament in a knee or otherwise, there's so much more to that student-athlete than just that injury and how it impacts their academic life, their social life, their physical life. And we have to address all of that. And that's really the premise of how this started here and in this primary care world. We're now, across the country, primary care docs with family medicine, internal medicine training, also have sports medicine training. So now we're able to handle the injury side, the non-surgical injury side, but then work real closely with our orthopedic surgeons and our specialists in the community to best care for our kids and our student athletes.
I think some of the things a lot of folks would be surprised to hear, or perhaps not, back in the day, you had a trainer, and if somebody got hurt, you sent them to the doctor. And today it's the breadth of services that are available to student athletes as well as others and in specialized areas. When we talk about nutrition, mm-hmm. we talk about psychological services, we talk about just the rigors of mental training, but there are so many drug testing, keeping people on the right path.
Yes.
There's so many different areas now that we've stepped from a trainer to all of these different walks of life that really impact the student athlete on a day-to-day basis.
Well, and I think that's really key is that, you know, our athletic training staff here at MSU, many of them have been here for 20 plus years, have incredible experience and are very, very well respected nationally, not just for what they do on the field, but those that they train and come up afterwards. The team of people that we have that help take care of our athletes is a conglomerate of a lot. And a number of those, obviously the day-to-day hands-on is our athletic training staff who are outstanding. We have to trust that they're going to do what they do for the athletes, and they're the relationship on an everyday basis that those student athletes need. They're not a coach. They're not the judgmental. They're not the they're really there for the athlete in every facet of who they are. And then from that, we've created a pretty large team of people that includes not only our physicians and athletic training staff, but as you mentioned, we do provide sports nutrition services for our student athletes because it's an important part of who they are as people, not just as an athlete. We do that as well with sports psychiatry and psychology. We do it with exercise physiology and kinesiology. We do that with a whole slew of specialists and people within our program and outside to make the experience for athletes the best it can be. When they leave MSU, they have to know how to deal with life when they leave here. And it's not just in the workforce, but it's also taking care of themselves and their families. So we try to help instill some of that for them when they're here as well.
I think one of the other things about the beginnings of sport medicine at Michigan State, it was the commitment to the community at the beginning. It wasn't simply about the people who wore an MSU uniform. Mm-hmm. That from the beginning, the idea was that young people, older folks who wanted to remain elite in the work that they do, would be able to come and receive the services available through sports medicine.
You know, and that's a, believe it or not, and I think it's a misconception a lot of people have, that MSU sports medicine, our practice that we have here is not about our student athletes at MSU. Our practice is for the community. Mm-hmm. We are affiliated, we're part of the university, but our practice really caters to everything but the university athlete. We will see them in our office on a rare occasion. But I have a patient who's 90 years old, and the reason he came to see me is he loved to downhill ski. He was 89 at the time I saw him. He was turning 90 a month later. But the interesting thing is the reason he wanted to see me is by moving to the age of 90, he became now into the oldest age category. And there was a 5-state downhill ski racing program that he was in. He was worried about a guy that was 101 living in Indiana from Austria that was going to beat him if he didn't get his legs stronger to handle the last couple of runs during his racing. And that's sports medicine. Mm-hmm. It's the gymnast who's 5 and 6 years old who gets hurt. It's the high school athlete, of course, the group that we see all the time. And it's everybody like you and I who like to go out and walk. And we've kept our weight down. We're physically healthy because our weight's under control. We're eating better. But now we have a knee that swells, and we can't do what we've done for so long. So our motto is when you call our office, if you're active, you're in. You just got to be active. If you've not been active and you want to become active, you're in. Because we want you to feel that you can come to our practice to help you achieve whatever your goals are.
But if you want to remain a couch potato, you're probably not in the right spot.
We'll find another option for you.
Right, because your expectation of follow-up for rehab is significant.
Absolutely different animal. You're right.
From my personal experiences, I've had two doctors in my life that I consider I went to on an ongoing basis. One was Dr. Howe, and Jill and David actually taught me how to windsurf out on Lake Lansing when mm-hmm. I was a student. And the second is Jeff, and I think as you go through it, it changes. Like one of his advice is not to drink coffee, and he routinely sees me drinking mm-hmm. coffee.
Now, let me say, I just did finish moderate, my one cup.
Moderate the
right,
coffee.
Right.
But
I brought my tea today just because of that.
green
tea.
It does change the presence for me personally to know that on the road I'm going to see Jeff routinely and have that presence. And I think the things you talk about are extremely important because it is lifestyle. It is how you live. And, you know, not everybody can have their doctor on a road trip with them once a month and kind of check on you. But you do have the ability to see people beyond just the injury or beyond just the wound. And I think that's an important component in how we take care of kids and how you should take care of yourselves out in an everyday life. It's more than just the elbow. It's how are you living.
Well, and it's really interesting. You know, my kids now are to the age where I have a senior in college, I have a sophomore in college, and a high school junior. So you learn a lot as time goes from your own kids, obviously, and your own family. I've grown so much as a physician taking care of student athletes by having adolescents and now young adults as children. When you watch your kids and you think when one of these student athletes walks in, this could be my daughter or my son, they've never filled a prescription by themselves before. I can't just send them to a pharmacy. So you have to talk through what happens when you walk through a Rite Aid front door and where do you go and how do you take the script and what do you have to bring with you and make sure you have identification. And it may cost you $10, $20 for a copay because otherwise they're a fish in a big sea that if you can give them those little pieces, that's all part of taking care of that athlete. So it's not, it isn't just the illness, the injury, the things that affect how they play. it's how they work away from the field too that we have to really look at, and that's what we try to do, and that's what we try to instill in our training staff and our physicians across the board, that these kids have a lot in their world. It's not just about the game, and sometimes what we see isn't really what's reality. We have to delve into it a little deeper to find out why.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
And you're listening to a conversation between Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon, Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis, and MSU Sports Medicine and Performance Leader Dr. Jeff Covan.
Before we leave, talk a little bit about head injuries, because that's gotten the biggest press recently. The Big Ten, Michigan State, was again at the forefront in trying to understand head injury and head injury practices. We partnered with the Ivy League. So I'd like for you to talk a bit about that, but also, as you can weave into that, some of the issues and challenges you have about young people who believe that they'll lose their place if they really honestly deal with an injury, as opposed to ignoring it to try to stay on the depth rotation.
We'll come back. That's a really tough one. And a conversation I've had with my own daughter who plays soccer here a couple times. The concussion one is a fascinating injury. It's a fascinating topic. It's a really challenging one. The Big Ten and the Ivy League about 3 years ago, give or take, jointly looked at concussion because both were doing some individual work, and Jim Delaney felt at that time that we needed to step forward and do more. And with the commissioner of the Ivy League, together decided, let's put some resources together, let's put some minds together, and let's start talking about not only how do we look at and manage a concussion, but what other studies, research are being done across the conferences that maybe we can do together. Maybe we can jointly get resources and using our athletes as a means to help get more information, how can we do this? And we just had our second meeting in July. I was in Chicago for that meeting, and it was incredibly well represented by both conferences with physicians, researchers, athletic training staff from all the different schools, just brainstorming on what each other are doing currently, discussing current research, whether it's how do you evaluate an athlete on the sidelines versus what diagnostic studies, MRIs or what we call fMRIs or these other studies can give us markers or biomarkers to predict who's at risk for some of the really problematic things we've seen with some of these NFL players 30, 40, 50 years after the careers are done. And so there's been a combination of things done between the conferences to really try to bridge that gap between what's happening on the field and then what's happening in the lab and how do we bring those together. And it's been a really interesting process. We've got a few people on campus here. Dave Kaufman is one of who runs our neurology program. Dave's phenomenal relative to, as a thinker, how do you bring in the interesting questions and then how do you bring the people together to do the work? And he's been working with us very closely with athletics now on the sidelines of football games, in our training rooms for different sports, seeing some of these kids not only with concussion but other neurological related symptoms. And those kind of people across the two conferences have really helped us push forward the research that I think is going to make a difference. It may take a number of years to get there, but I think it will make a difference in how we not only manage them on the front end, but really who can we prevent having problems long term.
Your daughter's a soccer player.
Yes.
And soccer is actually one of the more significant head injury sports, though football gets all of the attention.
True.
Because of the high-impact collisions. So for parents who might be listening, whose kids are out playing soccer, or softball actually for women is one of the other issues because they've forgotten how to slide and they want to bowl people over, so they duck their head instead of learning how to slide. So what can you tell parents about being really concerned about these issues and sort of child development, and are there places to go to get more information?
You know, I think one of the areas relative to concussions in children, especially in soccer, is if you look at a lot of the studies over in Europe where soccer obviously is their primary sport, it's a pretty high impact, pretty high yield of injury there. We're seeing it here, but I think the key is there's a technique in hitting a soccer ball that if you do it appropriately and you're trained to do it correctly, you'll limit the stress on the brain relative to that. Now, will you completely? No, you can't completely, but essentially there's a way to. And if you're taught the right way to do it, there's ways that you can eliminate or really decrease the frequency and the risk. Now, if you get a ball off the head that you don't see coming as a fan sitting in the stands, they kick a soccer ball and you're talking to somebody, get hit in the head, you can't prepare for that. There's no way. And those are the people who are going to sustain some of those injuries. But in soccer, if we can keep the younger children away from heading a soccer ball, it's going to have a huge impact on decreasing that risk. As they get older and their necks are strong enough to absorb that, and that means it comes back to coaching. Once coaches understand, just don't let kids head the ball. Use the rest of your body to control it. And when they're strong enough, which could be anywhere from 12 to 13 to 14, start really implementing the correct way, we can have a huge impact on that. So it comes back to, as a parent coach, which I was, I didn't understand that very well. I mean, I remember doing drills with fourth and fifth grade boys that they loved because there was a big mud puddle in front of the goal. So we did a header drill so they could dive through the mud puddle. It wasn't heading the ball. It was just diving through the mud puddle that they wanted to do. But it was teaching them how to head a ball. But they probably were still too young to do that. And I think as parents who are coaches, we need to make sure that we as the coaches understand maybe it's not the right time. Teach them other skills and techniques early. Let the more advanced coaches teach that when they get older.
And this is part of the downside of organized sport and all of these traveling teams and everything else that occurs, where folks at a very young age now are being told to specialize in one sport, to try to get on the traveling team because that's the success that goes into here and that's your best chance to get a college scholarship. I think some of the research also suggests that if you want your son or daughter to be healthy and safe in sport, doing a variety of sport that exercises different muscle groups and really develops the whole body at a younger age is potentially better in the long run than simply practicing that one sport with the particular muscle groups that are for that sport.
I agree completely. And I think the more we can cross-train ourselves as adults as well as children, the better you are able to adapt and adjust to the stresses of the sport and the muscle that goes with it. So it's a hard one, though, because there is so much pressure on these kids so young to make that decision. But the more sports we can get them, like my daughter, for instance, played soccer. That was her sport. She decided early on that was her sport, played volleyball a little bit, but at 5'2", that wasn't where she was going to go with it. My son loves playing everything. He does all the different stuff. And I think because of that, he's been better off and is healthier as an athlete as a whole.
Okay. So now the we'll end with the more difficult question, which is, I really want to compete. I live to compete. I want to sort of move up in the depth chart, and I have this injury I'd like to be able to, and if I'm sitting out there, somebody else is going to take my spot.
And it happens. It does happen. And people always say, and I don't believe it, that you can never lose your position to an injury. Once you come back, you're back, and that doesn't always happen. I think one of the things that I tell people all the time, and we see adolescents in our office all the time that are injured, and they're in that prime couple of years where now they're kind of recruitable as an athlete and they've got their injury. And I tell these athletes all the time, as I say, look, our job in sports medicine is to keep you playing safely. We want to put you back in the field. We want to protect you. We want to splint you. We want to let you continue to play your game safely. We can't put you out there when you're going to put yourself at so much more risk that the next injury could be significantly greater. But on the same token, as a softball pitcher with shoulder pain or elbow pain, if you go out and pitch and your velocity or you're not throwing the ball as hard as you're usually doing, now they're hitting you more. Those coaches on the sidelines recruiting you are not seeing the athlete they thought they were going to see. And all they see is, she doesn't throw the ball as hard as I thought she could. She doesn't have the movement on her ball like I thought she would. They're not asking why. They're going to see somebody else. I said, so as an athlete, if you go out there and can only play at a certain percent of who you really are, not only are you affecting your potential growth as a player in other people's eyes, but are you really helping your team? And are you really putting your team at more risk because you're not able to play at the level you need to, and therefore it affects the whole and not just yourself. So I try to use those examples with these athletes to say a week of downtime right now is going to have a huge impact on your ability to come back to the player you want to be, as opposed to trying to force it. But again, like we talked before, even we got on the radio, It's communication and it's talking through it and trying to understand it and making sure that they can see that, buy into it, and then let them help drive it a little bit with their own goals and their own agendas, right, too.
I think one of the strengths, and this is a tribute as well to you, to the development, I think, of sports medicine here, is a very interdisciplinary sort of team effort. Trainers, a lot of activity, interaction with the coaching staff, the leadership that Mark's provided, that it takes a team around an individual to send the same message. If the coach is sending one message and the athletic trainer is sending one message and you all are sending a different message, or the athletic department sending a different, then the student athlete is then pulled and tugged across a lot of competing values. And so I think part of what you've done with your leadership with Mark is to get everybody sort of oriented towards the same values.
I almost view it a little bit like an air traffic control, where Jeff is in the tower and you cannot allow all these individual disciplines to fly on their own course. They have to be choreographed, they have to be coordinated, and that's what Jeff just does a masterful job with, is making sure that the student athlete in the end has all of these different services funneling into a productive way for the best quality of life and the best performance possible.
Well, you know, and one of the things that's happened this year, thanks to Mark, is that we've kind of created a little different infrastructure model within our healthcare of our student athletes, where I'm now overseeing these different entities within our program to, one, make sure that we're all on the same page. And it's also given me a little time now to venture into a coach's office more so and talk away from the field about what are you getting or what do you need from us. And before I make a statement that, you know what, don't worry about it. If you can't, we can redshirt you this year. You can come back a fifth year. Well, that sounds great. And in the real world, everybody out there thinks, oh, of course you can. Well, in football and basketball, you have a few more scholarships than you do in some of the other sports. And you learn that I can't just tell an athlete that, you know what, yeah, I know your shoulder's sore and you're not being able to play. Let's redshirt this year. You'll come back for a fifth. You know, but a coach has to be thinking in the same line, where do I have a position available? Do I have funding available? And sometimes those are the decisions that I can't make. I need to be in that communication with coaches and training staff and other specialty people to best serve the athletes. So they're getting accurate information and not a lot of mixed messages, because the mixed messages is where the confusion comes in, the parents get concerned, and it's just being consistent across the board.
Yeah. It's terrific that Michigan State University was part of the initial movement to establish sports medicine with a different philosophy, and we're blessed to have you as our leader now. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That was Dr. Jeff Covan, who leads MSU Sports Medicine and Performance, talking with Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon. There's more online at sportsmed.msu.edu. And to hear this conversation again, please visit spartanpodcast.com. Up next, Simon and Hollis return to talk with MSU J-School Prof Sue Carter.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Making a Michigan State University education accessible to all is a key pillar of President Simon's Boulder by Design initiative. And that's why MSU Alumni Association chapters around the world raise hundreds of thousands of dollars in scholarship money each year. Our members share our belief that the same educational experiences we enjoyed should be available to future generations of Spartans. That's why we support MSU's innovative Grandparents University, where you and your grandchild can learn from some of Michigan State's most gifted professors. It's why we touch thousands of lives each year with our career enrichment seminars. And it's why MSU Alumni Association chapters are among the first to welcome new students at dozens of annual freshman family picnics in every city from Detroit to D.C. The MSU Alumni Association was founded to add Spartan value throughout your Spartan life. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
MSU Today is online at spartanpodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with MSU J-School Professor Sue Carter.
Well, there's a lot of ads that are out there on the radio for the world's most interesting man. I think with us right now is the world's most interesting woman. It's Sue Carter, Dr. Sue Carter. It's great to have you join us. And you know, I think you're a rock star in the College of Communication Arts. I feel very blessed to be alongside you in many different walks of life, and thanks for joining us today.
Mark Hollis, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you and with President Simon as well.
You know, I'm going to – everything I talk about is experiences that you have an opportunity. I have had an opportunity to sit in a classroom with you and watch the dynamics that you have with young minds and shaping them into roles for the future. Talk about, with all of the vast experiences that you've had, talk about what that means to your life to have that opportunity to be in the classroom and engage students.
It is tremendous. And I remember what Krista McAuliffe said. And you may remember she was the teacher who went up on the Challenger. She said, "I teach and I touch the future." And that, I think, is the greatest gift back to me from that interaction with students, is that we get to imprint and encourage and help develop minds and inquiries so that they can go off and do great things. You know, sometimes they achieve, sometimes they fall a little flat and have to be lifted up again. But it's the ability to work with young people who are in a position at a time in their lives when they're really exploring.
One of our alums, Tom Gores, has a ideology, which part of it is called HALO, which is living your life high above life's obstacles. And you do that. I don't see any harness holding you back in anything that you do.
That's what my mother always worried about, too.
Right.
From motorcycles to expeditions to you live life every day.
I do. I've been blessed to by God. That's my faith. And to have a great life. And I think part of the expectation is that I fill it and live it. And I do it sometimes by offering examples to others. And in the expedition that we put together to the North Pole, and that's been 13 years now, I come across young people we talked with when we went into classrooms and we did a webcast from the North Pole. And they say, "Because of what you did, I went out and did X." And I think, boy, that's great, you know, that you set your own goals and you got to achieve. And I'm thankful for the people who went before me who said, "You can do these things."
The motorcycle. You ride a motorcycle.
Yeah, fly. I just did my biennial the other day. Flew down to Howell with the instructor, you know. And when someone is testing you while you're in the cockpit, I was pretty sweaty when I got out.
So when you go through those things, what do you hope to get out of them on the back end? And what's out there in the future? Like what motivates you to do things most people kind of just say, "That'd be cool," but you actually take it beyond that and you actually reach out and accomplish?
Boy, that's a great question, Mark, and I think it's a good one for you and for me and for you, President Simon. I think testing ourselves, pushing ourselves, who said that one's reach should exceed one's grasp, mm-hmm. and just keep out there pushing. It makes each day valuable. Each day memorable, as long as I have a memory. And it really lets us explore and see what we can do. Not just what we think we can do, but what we can do.
Yeah. When you've been around this campus, as most of us at this table have.
Yeah, we are long of tooth for a while. Yeah.
As you look around this campus, some of the things we've been talking about internally is stereotypes, and it's not stereotypes of the people that we serve, but the stereotypes of ourselves, of trying to describe Michigan State University and what we are and how people perceive what our campus is. And it's kind of unique because we're so many different colleges and we're so many different business units, I guess, operating in a very large footprint. What do you think some of our stereotypes are as a campus as a whole?
That's very interesting because recently there was a survey shared among various faculty and administrators, I gather, asking us to list the kinds of views that we have of ourselves and that we believe others have. Mm-hmm. I think first and foremost, we are accessible. And I put friendliness in that. Mm-hmm. Michigan State has always struck me as not only a research institution, but importantly as an undergraduate institution. And for a place this large, that's important because we are the first level of the next generation's learning in higher education. So accessible. I think, I got to throw in beautiful. I had a friend of mine from the U of M the other day who mercifully did not wear his Michigan shirt. I said I wasn't sure I could protect him. And we're driving around campus. He hadn't been on campus. And he said, "This is really a beautiful place." And I said, "Well, thank you. You know, yeah. It is well maintained." I think the research that we do touches the lives of people, and all of us here have had a chance to see how that affects people who are not only in this state but in countries that lie beyond our national borders. And sports is an important part. I love it. You're clearly a part of it. It's where people gather. And in fact, we're doing a documentary this fall. The Michigan Humanities Council gave us a grant to do a documentary on tailgating. Well, I figure I may as well have fun if I have to do something. And the title of it is Football Tailgating, Where Michiganders Love to Gather. So we're going to five different game locations in the state. But tailgating is an important part of sports, and it lets us understand that we are collectively a family. We may have very deep rivalries, mm-hmm. but we're a family, and we love to gather around sporting events. We love to encourage our young athletes to exceed what they think are their limits.
Mm-hmm. Sue, you're part of a work. We've done Spartans Will 360.
Yeah.
And now you're sort of advocating Spartans Will 720.
Let's double it first.
So talk about it from a faculty member's perspective, why people, faculty members, get excited about something like Spartans Will 360, why it isn't, you know, I think simply just a branding campaign, but it's really a part of, you know, what we do.
Yeah, thanks, President Simon. It is much more than that. Spartans Will 360 was and is, because it continues on, is an important showcase of what we do, and it lets us get excited about sharing the research that takes in myriad forms. It can be agricultural, it can be very technical, it can be in the social sciences and the humanities, but it lets us get excited about, yes, we are moving beyond the borders of our campus, and we're doing these things, and let me show you what we're doing. Let me share my excitement with you about places we go and then lives we touch and hopefully situations we improve.
And then your new idea?
Oh, yeah, well, this is where I have too much energy, Mark. Spartans Will 720 is the notion that we can engage the Spartan community in a financial way and maybe some other ways to contribute. And here's how it goes. I was in Bangladesh, and we saw people who were extraordinarily poor. It wouldn't take much money through a grant or through a loan to help them, in this instance, buy a piece of land, put up a structure, buy a couple of animals, create a little agricultural community that would be sustainable for them and provide them an ability to have an income. So the Michigan State University Federal Credit Union has agreed in principle, to be the recipient of funds that people could donate so that a group on campus, a board, would review applications for grants and loans and be able to make micro-grants using microcredit, which is an idea put forth by a Nobel Prize winner, an economist, who comes from Bangladesh.
Who actually worked with Michigan State University faculty early on in his days.
Right. So the yeah. circle, you know, yeah. Let the circle be unbroken. So I think it's an idea that would excite people who are associated with our university who maybe can't go, but they would give them a direct link and they could understand and see and feel and be a part of improving lives.
I've been in the home of several recipients of micro loans in Vietnam and very successful in providing resources for what you just talk about, a barn, a cow, an opportunity to generate crops and turn people that are extremely poor into something where they have an opportunity to live on their own and be something productive, proud, and change their lives dramatically. Right. So it's the first I've heard of this year, which is one of the great things about this radio show is sharing ideas. Yeah. But sure. It's an amazing project to get involved with, and I'm happy to know about it.
Well, thanks. And I think as a university, we talk very much about how we apply our research, and that's a way of applying mm-hmm. research as well.
Right. I think part of the idea, if you use the Bangladesh example or let's pick the microeconomics at any place of Spartans Will 360, it could be in Michigan, even in a mm-hmm. inner city neighborhood, a rural neighborhood that needs a little bit of a boost to think through this. It's not about us providing all of those services, mm-hmm. but the question is how do we potentially through this provide a magnet that others could contribute in ways that the money goes directly mm-hmm. To people as opposed to through a number of bureaucracies that
right.
that tend to mm-hmm. to take their share. But also then it, is another extension of the research, so that it's not about one demonstration project, because we're not going to do everything in a community, but we're going to go and demonstrate how we think people can make this work. It's another incentive to try to keep projects moving in complicated bureaucracies. Tell me a bit, we're at a time when it's the beginning of an academic year, and you are one of our terrific faculty members, long-serving faculty member. In the athletic equivalent, how do you sort of get up for the game of the new academic year and all these folks who are still 17 and 18 when they arrive as we get a bit older?
Boy, that's a great question. I've been here more than two decades. Part of it is driving around campus, and over the course of the past two or three weeks, I've seen the level of energy rise, whether it's just construction being finished, things being spruced up, more students arriving. The international students had the orientation the other day, and I was driving by Breslin. I thought, wow, this campus is getting populated again. So that's part of it. We have faculty retreats. Ours in journalism was last Friday, and that brings us together again as a faculty. We've been dispersed over the summer, so we see our colleagues and go, yeah, what are you working on? How is your summer? What are you doing? What are you teaching this fall? What do I need to add to my syllabus? So that's part of the re-engagement. In academic governance, as we look toward the fall, those meetings are starting, so we get to sort of help to set some agendas for the university in that regard. It's an infusion of energy that comes from other people that really does help that boost.
I think one of the things that when people think about universities, they often use the K-12 model. Mm-hmm. But faculty like you, your colleagues, remain very active over the summer in a variety of intellectual projects, papers, research, in your case, study abroad, that aren't located in East Lansing. Mm-hmm. So talk with people a bit about that sort of continuity of work, even though you're not in your office regularly.
Sure, right.
Or we're not, quote, in session. Even though we have like 25,000 students over the summer, we still feel like we're really small.
we've downsized.
We're downsized.
Yeah, but barely. There's a lot that takes place over the summer. You mentioned study abroad, and I've been able to participate and lead and co-lead programs for 15 years. And that's a great way of staying engaged and teaching in a different realm. To touch briefly again on Bangladesh, we had put together video for a documentary we sent off to Sundance for a pre-production grant. They turned us down, but interestingly, they said, send us a rough cut of 20 minutes. And we were going, oh my gosh, 20 minutes. In 2 weeks, we had to put it together.
It's a lot.
Right. And to complicate it, and this was in July, all of the interviews were in Bengali. Now, my Bengali's a little rough, I'm here to tell you. But because we are such an international community, we put a call out to several members saying, are there people on this campus right now in the summertime who speak Bengali? And by golly,
we had a lot of volunteers.
Yeah. So a lovely husband and wife sat with me, and we went through all of the interviews and translated all of the interviews for the documentary, sent off a rough cut. So those things take place over the summer. The nice thing about the summer is we've got the time to do that, to work on other things that sometimes get deferred from just the great busyness of the 9 months of the academic year, per se.
Research and intellectual inquiry never stop by what I would call term definition.
Mm-hmm.
There are programs that occur between semesters and study abroad, projects, travel, other things that are not bound by what people think about as classroom schedules.
Right.
And I think that's what makes this kind of university so great, because it happens around Michigan, around the world. So if you reflect back, you're in an area of teaching that from an external perspective, why would you be teaching journalism now when the world has changed so much?
Are you
much?
The parent of one of my incoming students?
really one of the questions it's that people question. Are really raising. And the college, your department, has really thought through that issue
Very much so.
And not simply said, oh, gee whiz, don't worry.
Yeah.
But, because we do care deeply about what happens to our students when they leave. So talk a bit about that process, because I think it's a good example of what a research university does.
That's an excellent area to address, because parents do have concerns. If we just start with the incoming students, parents do have concerns about paying for an education. The students have the same concern in a field that they hear is dying. Well, in fact, it's not dying. If you think about the news that we need and the greater amount of information that we need to have, there are three aspects to journalism: gathering the news, processing it, and distributing it. And while the distribution model has changed, the first two, we still need to gather news. We still need to process it. We need people who are critical viewers and reporters to be able to process that information. And we're figuring out distribution models. And we're working with students to become more entrepreneurial. Several of our courses address that and help them develop a multiple skills base so that they're not just print reporters or broadcast reporters or just headed to radio. They can do all of these things. They're skilled and can go out and do these things. So that's at the undergraduate level. At the graduate level, we understand and we seek to get a better knowledge base of how the markets are working, how journalism per se is being used, the different methods. We have a brand new professor, an assistant professor coming in, who is funded to do research with a new Google eyeglasses. And what does that mean for journalism? It has some great opportunities. So we're well beyond just, I'm going to be a newspaper reporter. We cover a broad field, working collaboratively with other units in our college as well, with the advertising, with communication, because it all works together. Those barriers are coming down.
One of, I think, the if people would look at Michigan State, journalism programs are often embedded in LSNA, liberal arts and sciences programs, sort of next to English.
Mm-hmm.
And your program, this program, is sort of embedded next to advertising, communication, lots of new media and technology. How does that make the thinking about journalism different?
I think it tells, and it's a good question, I think it tells us that journalism is not simply about English and writing. It's not, that's an important part, and our students are actually very good writers, so it's a joy to read their papers.
And that actually, writing skills are in demand in corporate settings beyond what you would think about as being in the media.
Right, no matter where you go. Employers say, we want someone who can write, because good writing is a sign of critical thinking and clear thinking. It says that journalism really is related to and very deeply involved with the other fields. The connections between journalism and advertising yield public relations, which is viewpoint communication, different from what journalism does, and yet there is a relationship. A number of our students go into public relations ultimately because they are good writers and they can bring in a whole set of skills, video, internet, web design, those kinds of things. So journalism can be in a lot of areas, but it is communication at the end of the day.
Mark and I, over the course of this program, including sort of the Izzo, whether he goes or whether he stays,
sure,
in Cleveland,
mm-hmm,
have talked about this sort of this rush to get something on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Because being first is potentially better than being right. And we saw that, again, replicate itself a bit in some of the crisis situations, mm-hmm, recently, whether it's in Boston or abroad, about that sort of first, right, versus right, where the old journalistic tradition was more right than...
Well, we like to think that the old one, but always...
If we dredged up Mary Gardner, she would probably at least say that. I mean, I think there's always a tension,
sure,
about timing and completeness or correctness. So how, when you think about the ethics of journalism,
mm-hmm,
now...
And I do teach the ethics of journalism. That's part of what I do.
So and particularly in this rapid-fire tweet...
Mm-hmm.
technology world. What do you tell people? What do you talk about in your class?
Well, I caution them against the sort of the real-time look-down. Think Columbine. Remember when we were just getting raw, unedited, live video, and we saw some images that were really pretty disturbing. There was no warning, no alert, no way to put it into context. And I work with students to help them understand that they have responsibilities as editors. And at the end of the day, we're all editors because we're responsible for our content. And I think that's a lesson that they hear. We look at photos. We try to make decisions about what should and should not be shown in what context and how to prepare people. And it is a competition, like many businesses, like marketing. You know, it's a competition. But I will point out that going back more than 200 years, when the ships came in from England, there were races by boats from Boston to see who could get there first to find out what cargo was on those ships so they could race back and put the news out. So
speed has always been an issue. Competition is always an
issue.
It's
in our DNA.
But it is a complicated business now with this sort of everyone having a phone that has capacity for video that was limited to a few not so long ago. Right. And then the sort of sense about how you put the ethics in that competition to meet your responsibility.
We can talk about it. We can teach it. We can work with students. I would suggest that the obverse side of that coin is that we need to make sure that the people who are receiving the information have critical skills as well. So that it's not just – because this is a two-channel process when
right.
we have phones that are capable of putting out all kinds of images. The person looking at that information, seeing, reading, also needs to be critical about what she or he is taking in. And that's part of what we teach, too. And that's communication literacy. So not only putting it out, but how do you assess all the information that's out there? We can't stop the flow because the genie is out of the bottle.
Yeah.
But it means that at both ends, we need to be as thoughtful as we can be, knowing that there's a huge flow, a torrent of information.
And I think that really is why it's important for places like this to fight against the trend that says that education should be more and more immediately technically relevant.
What was your undergrad degree?
Mathematics.
Mine was humanities.
So, yeah. So people might think mathematics is a little bit more relevant than humanities. But I think there is a sense that we can produce a competitive workforce by narrowing the amount of time spent on these extraneous things because. You know, engineering is exploding, so therefore we need more time on engineering. The technology in the media lab is exploring, so let's get rid of the ethics course and let's
right.
spend time on the real stuff that will get people a job. And I think if we want that two-way communication in the society that we all, I think, value if we do the surveys, there is a place for worrying about both sides of communication and right. what it means in terms of teaching those ubiquitous critical thinking skills that come in courses that probably an undergraduate or their parents believe is probably lower on the utility spectrum.
The last thing we want to be is the Spike Jonze School of Broadcasting Communication Arts. That simply teaches tools. Our students will go through multiple jobs and multiple careers during their lifetime, and we need to prepare them to think critically. Courses that I've taught included one on critical incident analysis that, you know, there were no tools there, but it's thinking through situations. I think you're absolutely right, President Simon, that we must maintain and hold that view that we are teaching for the larger life and the greater mind.
So I'm going to end with a controversial topic.
Oh, geez.
But one I know that you spend a lot of time thinking about. Mm. You, over your lifetime, have been an ardent fan of sport.
Mm-hmm.
You probably, by a definition, would be viewed as an athlete in terms of pushing yourself, whether it's the North Pole expedition or your own personal sense of activity and competition. And at the same time, you spent a little time being a sports broadcaster.
That's right. Yeah.
In your misspent youth, or maybe your misspent time here doing women's basketball most recently. So you're a part of that piece. At the same time, you're now the most visible leader of our faculty governance system.
That's right.
And the person that mm-hmm. would be called upon mm-hmm. if there's one person to ever speak for the faculty because of the role in academic governance and the role that you now play as the chair of the elected the group. The sort of the tension of sport and academics, or the way in which it can better be aligned. Mm-hmm. So
I think it's a question that you and I both wrestle with, you in your position as chair of the executive committee of the NCAA. It is a very difficult one. I think we are reaching a point, and it may be that the O'Bannon lawsuit is triggering some of our deep considerations about how athletics and academics meld together, interestingly enough, even though that deals with some financial pieces. I think we need to be very thoughtful about the extent to which we professionalize our sports and try to maintain levels of amateurism as much as possible, because it's not just the football players and the basketball players, but it's the field hockey player that I have in my class, or it's the softball player, or the wrestler with whom I've sat in another class with. They also benefit from what we have and what we can do. It's an encroaching, difficult problem. Maintaining academic integrity for student athletes, I think, is paramount. I think we do a very good job here at Michigan State, but we need to be always vigilant about mm-hmm. that. I have no solutions. I simply help ask some of the questions and make the inquiries, mm-hmm. I think, just as you do.
And this is a conversation that probably does not have a clear answer.
We live in ambiguity on those questions.
And so I do appreciate the work that you do in the classroom with your research and in your leadership for Michigan State University. So thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
That was MSU Journalism Professor Sue Carter talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association, the world's largest organization of Spartans helping Spartans. Wherever your Spartan life takes you, you're never far away from an MSU Alumni Association member who shares our dedication to community, connections, careers, and class. Help us expand the worldwide Spartan Nation. Join the MSU Alumni Association today at alumni.msu.edu.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.